Dr. Howard Jones, you're the leader of a stellar theme team. The team is called NTEL. The team is dedicated to neuroscience and technology-enhanced learning. Before we look at this particular issue, could you please briefly present yourself and your research?
My name is Dr. Paul Howard Jones. I work as a lecturer at the University of Bristol in the Graduate School of Education. My chief role there is coordinating the Neuroeducational Research Network. This is a loose affiliation of neuroscientists, psychologists, and educators who are concerned with issues at the interface of neuroscience and education. My particular interest is in the area of learning games, where we're studying how the brain's reward system operates and how that can give us insights into the way in which games engage us and the way in which those mechanisms can be used in learning games to support and motivate the learner.
Your main expertise is in the field of neuroscience and education. Coming to the more specific field of technology-enhanced learning, what is, in your opinion, the added value that neuroscience can offer to TEL research, and possibly vice versa?
I think that neuroscience is already impacting on educational thinking in a number of different areas. Developmental disorders, perhaps, is the area where it's most established, and you know, it's affecting how educators think about a variety of disorders such as ADHD, dyslexia, dyscalculia that mainstream teachers come across in their daily life. It's also giving us insights into how the brain continues developing throughout life. It also is helping us gain a better understanding of some complex relationships such as that between mild stress and memory, how stress can sometimes support memory and sometimes it can have the opposite effect. It's giving us some very visual images about the role of working memory in learning new mental processes. It's also helping us to understand how we learn through visualization, imitation and observation. These are all areas where it's impacting generally.
So, in your opinion, will neuroscience play a significant role in the future within technology-enhanced learning?
I think there are several reasons why you might expect neuroscience will have particular relevance within technology-enhanced learning. First of all, the types of observations that neuroscientists make are very often with computer-based experimental procedures, and so our understanding of how the brain works is quite often best applied to those sort of situations where you have a very rapid, responsive system which is giving feedback almost instantaneously. The other thing is that these are two very fast-moving streams of influence, technology and neuroscience, and so I think there is an expectation that at their confluence, where these two come together, there are going to be some particularly interesting possibilities in terms of theory and also application. There is also the possibility that neurobiological feedback, which is being increasingly studied as an interesting scientific concept in itself, may have possibilities in terms of it being incorporated as one of the outputs from a computer that actually supports the learner. And I think it's also perhaps not too much to hope that TEL researchers in the field of technology-enhanced learning, are possibly more open to the idea that there are concepts being developed outside of their field, developments which are impacting on their thinking all the time. And I think there's a sense in which TEL researchers are possibly more open to the idea that there are new ideas and new developments out there which could be constructively included in their thinking and in their research. So, as well as those close similarities between the types of situation that neuroscientists study and the types of situation in which the learner is gaining this very rapid feedback in human-computer interaction, I think there are also sort of political reasons, if you like, why you might expect neuroscience to have its first major set of impacts within the field of technology-enhanced learning. I mean, there are also, of course, what you might call more science fiction possibilities in the future, more futuristic ideas, such as computer-brain interaction, which is a reality, it's demonstrable, but at the moment it needs a lot more technological development before it actually can be usefully applied, I think, in learning.
There's a general consensus that neuroscience research findings can actually help those with special needs, like students with learning difficulties and other types of disabilities. Do you think that mainstream education can also benefit from neuroscience, and to what extent?
It is true that neuroscience has possibly become most established in education in the area of developmental disorders. And in fact, you know, there are several examples now where technology has been used as a platform for an educational intervention for children with dyslexia, dyscalculia. And I think, you know, if you want to look for examples of how neuroscience is informing technology-enhanced learning now, then you would be looking in the area of developmental disorders. However, its potential to inform is much broader than that. I think neuroscience has some important messages and will develop, you know, increasingly a big impact on how we teach mainstream learners and how mainstream learners can benefit from technology. I mean, for example, in my own area of research, we are studying how the brain's reward system responds to uncertainty. And that is providing us with insights about how we become engaged with games and how an understanding of those processes can give rise to a set of principles, if you like, for designing learning games. And so that type of research is very much not about developmental disorders, although it might have application there as well. It's really about mainstream learning. And I think there are many concepts arriving from neuroscience that we can apply in mainstream learning with technology. So I really think it would be a mistake to consider that neuroscience is all about developmental disorders. That is, you know, to some extent, that impression, I think, has been created historically.
What are the most common investigation techniques adopted by neuroscientists? In your experience, can they actually be adopted in educational contexts or for research purposes, for example, with children?
There are many techniques used by neuroscientists. Some of them are quite old, but there are new ones coming on stream all the time, and I think that those techniques of measurement might have particular interest, some of them, for technology-enhanced learning researchers. And you know, some of the old techniques, for example, skin temperature, skin conductivity, breathing, heart rate, those old physiological measurements are still very useful because they are cheap, they are comfortable, and they can be used in a variety of different contexts. Some of the newer methods, such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, produce clearer images of what's happening in the brain in terms of spatial resolution, so you can see where the activity is happening. But of course, those sorts of methods are less comfortable, and they are more difficult to use to study real learning contexts. So fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, very good at giving the spatial position of where brain activity is increasing, for example. But there are other techniques such as EEG, electroencephalograms, which measure electrical field above the scalp using electrodes. And those sorts of methods, I mean, again, they are actually quite cheap, especially compared with something like fMRI. Very good at giving information about when an event is happening, not always quite so good at telling you where in the brain it's occurring. And then there are other methods you know, which actually combine the two, like magnetoencephalograms, and those are often the most expensive methods. But I think it really is a matter of asking yourself, you know, what sort of question do we need the answer to, and what is the best method to use? There's no one method that is perfect.
Do you think that there's a specific technology that's suitable for every situation, or do you think that different technologies are best employed within different contexts and with different subjects?
So I think it is all about context. I think you have to ask yourself what you're trying to measure, and you know what sort of context you would really ideally like to make that measurement in. For example, we wanted to know how a particular signal quite deep in the brain was varying with different types of gaming event. So we had to use adults in an MRI scanner because we felt it would be too uncomfortable an environment for children in that sort of experiment. But then you have to make huge caveats and be incredibly cautious when you're trying to make statements about how those results might apply to children. Then, on the other hand, if you want to make measurements with children, you might want to use some physiological measurements such as skin temperature or skin conductivity in an authentic learning situation in a classroom. But then you need to be very careful about what you think that signal is actually measuring. I mean, for example, skin conductivity changes with emotional arousal, but what sort of emotion is it? It can go up with stress, but it can also go up with surprise. It can also go up with happiness. So when you have an increase in skin conductivity, what are you actually going to? What do you think that actually represents? So, you know, even if you make a measurement with EEG, for example, which is measuring the electrical field of the brain directly, there are limitations there because it can be quite difficult, you know, as I've said before, to make statements about where you think that activity is taking place in the brain. And it's really only good for cortical activity on the surface area of the brain. It doesn't really measure activity deeper within the brain. So I think that there are a wide variety of techniques that neuroscience is suggesting can be useful, but I just think you need to be very careful about selecting them. Although I also think you need to be very careful about not getting too hypnotized by the high technology approach of using these very expensive imaging techniques always, because some of these simpler measures can be extremely informative, and we have used, for example, skin conductivity in understanding how adults respond to different types of gaming scenario. So I think it's horses for courses. You have to think really carefully about the type of context you want to measure in and what sort of questions you want to ask. And there is no one ideal neurotechnology which is going to tell you everything and be suitable for every situation.
We see now that there are many commercial software products that claim to improve brain activities and cognitive functions. In your opinion, are these grounded on a solid scientific basis?
I think the huge interest in computer-based brain training is very interesting from a number of different aspects. I mean, first of all, there is clearly a huge commercial market for technology that is seen to support learning based on our understanding of neuroscience. And actually that is a real possibility of producing products in that marketplace which could be extremely effective and useful. At the moment, the types of products that you're looking at in terms of brain-based training, using technology, are not usually evaluated in a scientific way, and some of the claims that they make about being based on neuroscience are difficult to support when you actually look at the science that is being referenced, if indeed any science is being referenced, and it often isn't. Recently I undertook an evaluation for Which magazine of a variety of these different brain training bits of technology, and it was quite interesting to see that there is a terrible lack of scientific scrutiny of the actual products themselves, but there is also some strong evidence, I would say, in the scientific literature that such products can be designed and might well be effective. And I know that brain training computers are being used, for example, in clinical trials to look at whether they can support recovery from brain trauma, whether they can actually help control Alzheimer's. And there are a number of schools now which are buying brain training products for their children. And when you look at the science, there is actually some real research which supports the idea that such things might be useful. The science suggests that it's all about working memory. So there was a study done by Suzanne Yeagy from Innsbruck that found training young adults using an NBAC task, which focused very much on working memory ability, just half an hour a day, improved their working memory capability, but it also improved their flexible intelligence and fluid intelligence. And fluid intelligence is a good predictor of academic and professional success. It's that measure we use to gauge how effective you are at adapting to new situations. So it's very much about whether you can take on new concepts and new learning. So, you know, products that focus on working memory, I think, could be quite effective as brain training units, if you like. If that is the case, then educators have to start asking themselves, do we need to make space in the curriculum to use brain training? Do we need to take out more of the content in terms of the knowledge and focus more on developing cognitive function? Because in a world where information is increasingly available through technology, so you don't have to remember it, in a world where it becomes increasingly more of an issue trying to find the correct information and developing the mental and the cognitive skills to be able to use the vast amount of information that technology makes available, in that sort of world, then you can imagine that training cognitive function of children may be more important than actually delivering content in terms of facts and knowledge.
Dr. Jones, in a recent article of yours, you mentioned the idea of neuromyths. Could you explain something more to us about these? And perhaps maybe you could identify some of the most common neuromyths that are related to education and technology enhanced learning in particular.
The other reason why technology enhanced learning as a field should take notice of neuroscience, I think, is that neuroscience is already entering by the back door, if you like, and sometimes the form in which it arrives in educational thinking can reflect a lot of what we call neuromyths. The idea of some sort of story has developed, very often around some seed of truth, but the story that has evolved around it about the brain and what neuroscience tells us is actually very uninformative and often very unhelpful. And there are many neuromyths already circulating around schools and colleges and universities. And I think there are also some neuromyths which are developing that are specific to technology enhanced learning. So I think that there are certainly, you know, reasons there, if nowhere else, for technology enhanced learning to take notice of neuroscience. I mean, one myth which has been around for some time is that identifying a learner's style of learning is going to support them in their learning. So if a teacher can identify, or if a piece of technology can identify somebody's learning style, then if you teach them, or if they are supported, if their learning is supported, with taking note of that preference for that learning style, that is somehow going to enhance their educational potential. Now, there are over 70 different types of learning style inventory questionnaires that attempt to identify a learner's preferred style of learning. But actually, there is very little evidence, and there's no firm evidence at all, to support the idea that this helps in an educational sense. So with this increased interest in personalised learning, it is sometimes assumed that there is going to be some gain to be made from understanding a learner's preference. But actually, there is an assumption there that understanding a learner's preference is somehow going to support their learning potential. And that's where the evidence is missing. And this idea of learning styles, is, you know, or the many different inventories and the many different theories around learning styles that are produced, often draw on neuroscience as a justification. For example, with visual, auditory and kinesthetic, it's pointed out that we have different parts of our cortices that specialize in visual, auditory and kinesthetic processing, and that's an argument for learning style theory. But in fact, the brain is hugely interconnected, and the science does not support the learning style theory which is being promoted. And then there appear to be neuromyths which are now being generated, which are specific to technology. So, for example, in this country, we have had headlines saying Facebook infantilizes teenagers' brains, you know, and also there have been stories that computer games may cause autism. And in actual fact, there is no neuroscientific evidence to support these ideas. I think it's wholly reasonable that parents see their children immersed in technology, and there is a natural concern to know whether this is affecting brain development, and I think that there are real questions that need answering. And so that, if you like, that concern, that understandable concern, is the seed of truth. But around that seed of truth, there has risen this idea that neuroscience is already providing research evidence that these concerns are founded on scientific fact.
Okay then, Dr. Jones, thank you very, very much for this. It's been very interesting, and best wishes to you in your future research in this field. And we hope we have the chance once again to share the future findings with the Stella community on another occasion. Thanks once again.